I'd like to call the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order on Friday, February 12th, 2024. We do have the minutes, a quorum is present, and we have the minutes before us for April 9th, 2024. Vice Chair Hewitt, do you have a motion for us?
So moved, Madam. I'd like to move the minutes.
All right. Is there any discussion to the minutes of April 9th, 2024? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the approval of the minutes are adopted. With us this morning, we have Chair Gomez with House File 5336. I understand you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to discuss the A1 amendment? I think that the bill be before us and the amendment be before us.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, members of the committee, for having me this morning. So the A1 amendment is a section that is of concern to this committee. The reason that we're in front of you today is because of duties for the Office of the State Auditor included in the changes to the local sales tax provisions, which is what House File 5336 is. So the A1 adds a piece about annual financial reporting to section five. And so that was at the request of the Office of the State Auditor to add this annual financial reporting language.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions about the A1? All those, go ahead.
Oh, Madam Chair, we'll note that this was, you're basically hearing a clone of the local sales tax bill, and this was included in an author's amendment that we adopted in taxes.
So we don't need to adopt it? Is that what you're telling me?
I wanted to put it in front of the committee because the OSA changes are sort of concern, so yeah. Wanted to make sure we brought this, but all right. Just so everybody knows.
All right, and just to be clear, our intent is to lay this bill over. Right, so, okay. Members, any questions to the A1? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one. So, and Representative Gomez, good morning.
Thank you. So
you're intending that each calendar year, I mean, every calendar year, regardless of where they are in this sales tax collection, they're to report on the capital, they're to report to the auditor on the capital projects that these funds are being used for every year. Is that correct?
Chair Gomez.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions to the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 is adopted. You know, Chair Gomez, just to make this clean and neat, why don't we just refer this bill back to your committee and then it's all in your jurisdiction? What do you think about that?
Madam Chair, I mean, I would say it's up to you. The bill is where it needs to be in my committee, so there's no need, certainly, to re-refer it to me because this is a clone
perfect.
Of the original bill. So,
okay, just trying to make things neat and tidy.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. All right. To the bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure what the convention of your committee is. In taxes, we kind of like don't constrain our conversation to the jurisdiction of the committee necessarily, but you know, I'm happy to just kind of talk about the auditor requirements or to go into the overall bill. It's up to you.
No, you can just talk about the auditor's requirements. That's
great. So the House File 5336 makes changes, just, you know, high level, makes changes to requirements for local sales taxes. It allows local municipalities to without coming in front of the legislature to put local sales tax proposals in front of their communities, you know, for via referendum. So the issues that are in the jurisdiction of the of state gov are just, you know, we basically ask. Right now, we have a system where, you know, the legislature kind of oversees, in a manner of speaking, the local sales taxes, and it kind of politicizes the issue in a way. And so, you know, the state auditor has experience doing sort of some kind of oversight of the requirements for tax increment financing. And so the idea was just sort of to give them some authority to oversee it so that it took some of the legislative kind of political aspects out of it. So.
I have on my list that the auditor wants to testify. If Auditor Blaha would please come forward at this time. Welcome to the committee, Auditor Blaha. If you'll state your name for the record and present your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Cleghorn and members of the committee. My name is Julie Blaha, and I'm your state auditor. And here to speak to the parts of this, the bill that applies to us. We do appreciate how important local sales tax is as a tool and to all of you. And so we appreciate the effort to basically help simplify the process where we can, to go to a vote, and to give you the data you need to make long-going decisions about this. So after talking with the authors, Commissioner Marquardt, watching the working group a bit this summer, so I believe what you're looking for is this. Basically, certification, kind of like our assessments for local government aid and county program aid and some TIF reviews. And then also data collection similar to what we do with our city, county, town budget and financial reports. So that's kind of how we structured this change, that would be the idea. So as we work, and we are continuing to work through this, of course, our goal is to make it as simple as possible, as clean as possible. We also could imagine that over the next few years, we would expect that this would be also refined as you see the data that we would share with you. Is that the data you want? Do we need to change that? Kind of like we do again with TIF, with pension, with all of that stuff. We come back to you to refine as we go to get you what you need. As far as costs for this role, we've been working on our estimate, and these discussions have been really helpful to that process. So in form, we're going to be asking just for a direct appropriation for FTE and instead of a percentage. So it's a little more consistent, since this, we anticipate with the scale of this to require some increase in staffing, but not something where it's going to really change that much based on the size of the expenditures or the revenue generation. So with that, again, we know it's an important tool, and we're here to support your efforts any way we can.
All right, thank you. Can I just ask a really broad question?
Yes.
And Chair Gomez, I apologize, I didn't ask you this privately before. So if we have a state auditor who is really opposed to local taxes, would this bill mean that it would be difficult for a municipality to pass a local sales tax?
Yeah, I would actually just pass that to Auditor Blaha.
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Cleghorn. Great question. And I think that is the important part of this, how we build this structure. The structure needs to be, you know, we the kind of work we want to do in these kind of things is we have a tight standard and we follow the standard, right? So the stricter and the tighter we make the requirements in this bill, the easier our job is. And I think where you would see it, ideally it wouldn't be that so much we're saying you don't get to do this, as much we're saying you'll have to go back to the legislature. Because again, there's always going to be another option for someone if they don't agree with our assessment. But I think, again, that really is key to get these definitions right. Just like we do at TIF, doesn't matter what we think about TIF, we follow the law. And we would follow what you set in front of us. And that's the whole goal here.
Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you. Thank you, Chair Cleghorn. So in Section 5, Subdivisions 1 and 2 is really like where the kind of oversight and reporting kind of portions are for the Office of the State Auditor. And really we're not actually asking the auditor to make, like, I don't think anything that you could describe as a judgment call. It's basically like certifying that the projects meet the statutory requirements. And so I don't know if the auditor thinks there's like some level of discretion associated with the kind of oversight that we're asking them to do. But from my reading, it's like a pretty kind of straightforward, like, does it meet this list? But thank you.
Thank you very much. Auditor Blaha, did you want to say something else?
Thank you. Yes, Chair Cleghorn. Our goal is to not have that. So we're continuing to work on this as it's laid over, also to tighten up any language, particularly around regionality, where we want it to be just, this is a region, this isn't, boom. We do not want discretion. We appreciate that you love that, and we're happy to let you have it.
Thank you very much, Auditor Blaha and Chair Gomez. It's just important that we get that on the public record. So that was the point of my question. Members, do you have any questions? Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Claiborne and Representative Gomez. The bill seems to limit as to what projects can be used for the local sales tax, and I'm just wondering why it's not expanded to use some of the things that are really important to local jurisdictions, like the flood mitigation, water problems, or wastewater treatment plants. Why was the scope just these few projects?
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Harder. So there were some changes. The use of local sales taxes has been the topic of discussion at the legislature for many years, and what kind of uses are allowed for, you know, the applications of local sales taxes to some extent have changed. And for example, I mean, in 2021 we passed, I think the reason that some of those items are not included is because in 2021 we passed sort of a definition of a kind of regional capital project, which included, as I recall, a single building being sort of one of the requirements, or a regional park and trail was also included. But, you know, that sort of definition excluded some of, I think, some of those wastewater and water quality treatment facilities. So this bill does limit what is kind of what cities can use local sales taxes for by right without coming to the legislature to ask for a dispensation. And those were, you know, in part based on recommendations that came out of a task force that met over the summer last year. They came out with a list of recommendations of kinds of facilities. I didn't include all of those in my initial proposal. You know, there's kind of been a long conversation about what constitutes regionality, what constitutes a capital project. But, you know, fundamentally, I guess, you know, local sales taxes, for decades we didn't grant them to anybody. You know, the cities of the first class had them, and for some reason Mankato, which I don't exactly understand, but that was on the list. And then, you know, for literally decades, because, you know, we restricted the use of local sales taxes for kind of general purposes of local government, because you know, it creates inequities across different communities with different tax bases. So, you know, if you're in a community that has a robust retail sales base, if you're in Bloomington and you have the mall there, boy, you could put a quarter cent sales tax on that, and then that city in particular really doesn't have to worry about property taxes in the same way as even a similarly kind of situated city that doesn't have that retail base. And so what we were seeing with the proliferation of these, and what we are seeing again, in my opinion, is a reinforcement of spatial inequity based on tax base. And so what that means, right, is that there are situations in which you could say, if we just let these things kind of go as people want to use them, that, you know, a young person's access to, you know, certain kinds of capital facilities that provide them with enrichment in their lives could depend on the accident of where they were born, the accident of whether they happen to live in a city that has a robust sales tax base or does not. And so that is the question that is really before us, and that it's hard to get us to the level of thinking like that, because frankly, we're all here to do a job for our local communities. And a lot of times that includes, like, hey, our local communities need to build this thing. They need to provide this service. We are here to try to help them. What I'm asking us to do is really to try to take a step back and to look at the bigger picture and to look at the entire system and to ask ourselves, are we interested in pursuing a future in our state which flies in the face of the way that we have historically dealt with tax revenue, which is to say, we're actually going to say no to that question. We're going to say that we believe that all people across the state should have access to equitable access to facilities that they need and that their local governments need. And it shouldn't be an accident of whether they have a rich property tax base, a rich sales tax base, that folks who don't live close to those things, they still should be able to build facilities that their communities need. And by allowing the unfettered proliferation of local sales taxes, we're moving in a different direction than that. So I apologize, that was a lengthy answer, but it sort of got a little bit more into the meat of this, the effort that's in front of the committee today.
Thank you. I think it's a fair statement to say that no matter where you live in our state, you should have a high quality of life.
Absolutely.
I agree with that statement. Representative Carter, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Chair Claiborne and Representative Gomez. I don't know if it's necessarily a question, but maybe we need to look at taxes in a broader base. We have so many jurisdictions that are being allowed to tax that it does seem in some ways a little bit unfair. And the reason why I say that is sometimes if I go to whatever retail place or whatever, I'm paying the state sales tax. Okay, then depending upon where I'm at, now I got a metro sales tax, and then I have a county sales tax, and then I have a city sales tax. And in some respects, it just seems a little unfair that I'm being taxed four or five times for the same product. Then maybe we need to look at a broader way as to how we tax the people of the city or of the state. And sometimes for your local jurisdictions, as a former county commissioner, you can paint things a certain way to make it look, you know, pretty good. Yes, we do need this. And then they'll say, if we tax this, you know, that'll keep your levy down. But that doesn't always necessarily happen, that people get taxed on whatever level. And our levies don't seem to be held down low. They continue to seem to rise. So that's just my comment, is that maybe we need to look at a broader area as to how we tax the people of the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carter. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Claiborne and Representative Gomez. Chair Gomez, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I was part of property taxes when we implemented some of these items back in 2019. So I really appreciate, because, you know, we didn't know the solution back then, what would be the right thing, but we just knew we needed to get a handle and sort of understanding all of the things coming through. So I really appreciate your attempt to try, you know, after seeing how it's worked for a number of years, to say what are ways that we can adjust, you know, what we're trying to do. So I really just want to say thank you for doing that. I just had a quick question. I know you came to me yesterday, and I probably should have looked at this a little bit more and have a conversation with you. Maybe you and I can just talk off base of this, but I just want to make sure, because I know some of these items like convention centers, libraries, parks, sports, we also fund some of these through like public dollars, whether it's bonding or whether it's your legacy. And so is our intention then is with allowing localities to do some of this, is that then they won't be coming back and asking in these other areas to for bonding or for legacy money or things like that, because then, you know, I think if people have the opportunity to actually tax on these themselves, will that free up funds for other projects in these other pools of funds? I was just curious your thoughts about that.
Chair Gomez.
Chair Claiborne, Representative Herr, that's a very, very good question. And, you know, I'll say that I feel like it's sort of like trying to get my arms around that. What I have noticed is, you know, bonding projects require a local match. A lot of times what you will see is a community comes in for the bonding project. If this just to be, is if they have a really good lobbyist, okay? They come in with their bonding project. They come in with their local tax to meet the local match, the local sales tax to meet the local match required. They'll come in with a request, also in my committee, for a construction sales tax materials exemption. They'll come in with a request for a TIF district. These tools, and honestly, like, we don't have a comprehensive way that we look at these things, to your point. We do not. We don't have... you know, I've never served on the bonding committee. Our committees meet at the same time, so there isn't even any overlap between our two committees, for example. And so, you know, I mean, in terms of, like, whether we are doing the thing that we should do as policymakers, which is take a step back, look at a system, look at what the kind of requests that are coming in from local communities, and see what state tools we have across the enterprise to meet those needs. Absolutely, that's not happening right now. And my bill doesn't solve that. I'm just going to be honest. It's something that This has been a really hard thing. These little changes that I made, I mean, if we did something like that, these little changes that I made, I mean, I'm just going to tell you, boy, I heard from cities, counties, all of their organizations. There are letters in your brief. People are not happy about this. Democrats are not happy. Republicans are not happy. None of the cities that want to come, you know, a lot of people want to come and get these things. You know, it's like this is because we have opened kind of the floodgates in 2019, which was the first year that we allowed a high property tax base community to come and get a local sales tax, which as I said before, was not the convention for several decades. As soon as we made that decision, we opened the floodgates to those property wealthier communities who a lot of times can hire that really great lobbyist who can come and work all of the different levers in the legislature. And so, you know, and that is another thing that reinforces inequities. And I mean, and this is not like a partisan thing. Honestly, like I'm actually standing up mostly for GOP communities by trying to restrict the use of these in higher wealth property tax rich cities, like that are now represented by Democrats. Like, so, you know, this kind of cuts in interesting ways politically. But I mean, Representative Hurd, like, you're so spot on. Is that, you know, we're not like, and you know, this relates to what Representative Harder was saying, which is that, yeah, we do need to take a comprehensive look at the way that we tax people. And what the reason that we're seeing these is because if you look by any measure, if you look at percentage of GDP, if you look at percentage of local needs, a lot of you have served as local elected officials and you know that budgets are tight. And that you make things happen on really kind of tight margins, because the tool that you have really is your property tax levy. And so when the state, which it has done, which over decades, right, the percentage of our budget that we're spending meeting the needs of local communities has just gone down and down as a state. If you look at schools, it's that way, and if you look at local governments, it's that way. Whether you're talking about LGA, CPA, you know, school aid, all of these things. And so what we're doing, right, by saying, oh, at the state level, we're going to be righteous and we're not going to pass taxes and we're not going to, like, fund government, we're just putting those hard decisions onto our local partners by not doing our job, because we actually have tools that are more equitable and more progressive and less regressive than your property tax levy, than your sales taxes. Because we have an income tax at the state level, which means that we're able, by using a progressive revenue tool like the income tax, then we're able to take that burden off of local communities going to their property tax levy, coming to the legislature and saying, I want this, like, weird creative use of these taxation tools. I want a local sales tax to, you know, to fund something that kind of doesn't normally fall into that area. So, you know, absolutely a comprehensive look is needed at all these issues.
Representative Nadeau. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Herb, you were finished, correct? Okay. Representative Nadeau, did you have a follow-up? I had your name again on my list, so I just want to make sure.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Gomez. So, use of the proceeds, I'm in Section 5, Subdivision 3. It says the political subdivision imposing the tax must not commingle revenue from a tax approved by the voters under this a previous tax. So I'm wondering why that restriction, why we would want to use that, put that restriction in there.
Can you tell me which line you're on?
Well, yes, I can.
Sorry, thank you.
I'm on line 5.19.
Thank you. 5.19.
I'm sorry, I made notes on one that doesn't have lines. So
no, thank you.
Yeah. So this is actually one of the pieces that I've gotten some feedback about from local government partners, that there's some challenges to this. I mean, I think that the idea was, you know, in including this language was really just for kind of clarity and saying, like, hey, we're approving these funds for a specific use, so we just want to make sure that the funds go to that use. But again, you know, this is I have received some written feedback. I'm having a meeting with local governments, I think, next week on this. And this is one of the issues that they identified as being a challenge. And I, you know, it's not something that I'm super attached to. I think it was just sort of, you know, yeah, an attempt to kind of keep things clean. But if it, to the extent that it presents problems for in the real world for local governments, I'm probably going to take it out, it seems like.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you. And following up on that, so, and just further down in subdivision 5, we're capping, the bill caps the total at 1%. Is that, that's your intent? So the only way that a local unit of government could exceed that would be to use the legislative process to come in and make that request, along with the additional requirements in the new section of the law that requires adjacent counties to comment on it, identify that need. Is that correct?
Chair Gomez.
Chair Cleavorn, Representative Nadeau, yes, that's correct. My intent was to cap this at 1%. Counties are allowed to impose a local sales tax for transportation, I believe, of 0.5% by right. So, you know, when you're getting up into, like, adding, you know, an extra 1.5, 2% to the sales tax, it's pretty significant. And so we have seen that in the past, and I did want to curb that. So I think that's plenty.
Representative Nadeau, last question.
Yep, thank you. And so the wheelage tax would be excluded from that 1% cap, or is that now to be included in the 1% cap?
Chair Gomez, and I'll just remind everyone, this is a state and local government. We are the, our primary.
Sounds like a bunch of you guys want to come to taxes, so you're always welcome there. Because obviously, as you can tell, I keep going on. I love to talk about taxes. But wheelage tax, I'd have to bust out my little blue book. But I think that that refers to the county transportation tax. Yeah, so Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, the intent was for the 1% cap to be separate from the county transportation tax that's already allowed under statute by right.
Thank you. And then we're
going to. And my final question.
Quickly, please. We're going to wrap up this bill.
And thank you. Can you spend a little bit of time talking about the local sales tax equalization distributions? Maybe the nexus between a 1%. I'm not sure what the nexus is there for 1% for the auditor. If that's going to cover the cost, if that's going to be more than that, and then the 15% that's being distributed.
Chair Gomez.
So thank you. So we kind of started with an idea. Well, those are two different questions and one final question. So 1% there's 1% that has been collected, I don't know, since these things started for the Department of Revenue for their administration. We did add 1% for the auditor because we're asking the Office of the State Auditor to take on additional responsibilities here. The issue and the reason that we have Section 7, where there's a direct appropriation to the state auditor, which will come out of the tax budget, was because, you know, as we're moving forward, it's like we're asking them to do a bunch of work. We're saying we're going to collect 1% of we don't know what, whoever shows up to do these things. And so we just needed to provide them with, you know, kind of some more consistent revenue, certainly, to start out with. And so, you know, that's why both of those things are in there. I think the hope is that eventually the 1% will be adequate to meet the administrative needs of the state auditor so that it doesn't require an additional general fund expenditure to support this program, that it kind of all happens within the sales taxes. And then equalization fund. So basically, you know, I talked about that issue about whether we want to be a state where your access to amenities depends on your proximity to a robust sales tax or not. I don't think we want to live in that kind of state, and I think that we have a long history as a kind of on a bipartisan basis of saying that we don't want Minnesota to be a state like that. And so the equalization fund is my attempt to provide some equalization, to provide some support distributed via a needs-based formula to communities that don't have sales taxes, that can't opt in because they don't have like retail base. But, you know, of course, those communities still have needs. So that's the intent with the equalization fund, Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau.
All right, Lee Kosnick, I'm going to let you close up now.
Yeah, thank you. Kind of feel like we had a more robust discussion here in local government about taxes than we had time in the tax committee. However, I'm sure and certain that we will have more discussion in the tax committee. So I did kind of like your previous suggestion to move it back to the tax committee, but we'll let that be. Before we'd like to request a roll call on this, more for our members, but so, and I know you're a little light on your side.
We're just laying it over, so there is no vote.
All right. I guess generally, I didn't talk about this in tax committee. I think this is from the state government perspective. This is an, shows another instance where the legislature is abdicating some of its authority to the executive branch, and that's a cause for concern. We're growing a little bit of bureaucracy here with adding more more government and more employees, and then of course this makes it easier to raise taxes. So I have a lot of concerns about that. Chair Gomez, you know, you talked about this equalization and opportunities across the state to be equal. But I would suggest that that is why we have the whole fiscal disparities program and local government aid coming from a city or living in a city that receives none. I think those programs were established to get at some of what you're doing. But here we are circumventing a lot of that and making it easier to grow taxes and giving up some legislative authority. So have some current concerns about that. Had a few other questions, but we'll just move on with the agenda.
Thank you very much, Representative Kosnick. Closing words, Chair Gomez.
Appreciate the time in front of the committee. Yep. Certainly the intent with the equalization fund is not to circumvent any of the existing aids to local governments that are you know, distributed based on need. I think my intent was just to say, to the extent that this is raising in 2023, what was approved was $2.5 billion in taxes outside of our system, and they're probably going to add that to their calculation now of the total amount of taxes that we raised. But I do want to remind everyone that those were a lot of Republican proposals in there. But, you know, certainly it's nobody's intent to circumvent those, you know, those equalization efforts, but to say that if we are going to move in the direction of approving a lot of local sales taxes, that we want to apply that same principle of equalization to this revenue source that we do through fiscal disparities and local government aid and CPA to other forms of revenue.
And Chair Gomez, I'll just say before we lay the bill over that I really appreciate your dedication to making sure that we have a state that is fair and equitable for all. While you and I have had our differences, and I do appreciate the fact that you are interested in finding a clean, fair, standard process so that everyone is treated the same. And so I do greatly appreciate the work that you do, and I know that you and I have a lot of agreement in a lot of places. So thank you very much for the work you do. And with that, House File 5336, as amended, is laid over. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, next we will have Representative Howard, if you'll come forward. I will move that House File 4010 be before us. And since we have a few scheduling conflicts at the moment, I'm just going to ask you to walk us through House File 4010, and then we'll walk through the amendment, but we won't be voting on it right away. So if you'll please just walk us through House File 4010, please.
Thank you, Chair Cleburne. And you'll note that I'm not Representative Kozlowski, who wasn't able to be here this morning. I just want to note that Representative Kozlowski has done Herculean work on this bill this session to get it to the point it's at. And I also want to thank you, Chair Cleburne, for many hours of engagement as we work on this bill, an important one. Members, House File 4010 is a bill that recognizes that Minnesota has a housing crisis and that just doing things the way we've always done them is not going to be sufficient to meet the moment. In the state of Minnesota, we are more than 100,000 units of housing short of our need. It's one of the nation's worst housing supply gaps. And that really is the root of what's driving up costs for all Minnesotans, whether they're renters, whether they're homeowners. Last year, the legislature passed a historic housing bill with more than $1 billion in new investments, including hundreds of millions of investments that will flow directly to our local cities and counties to address their housing needs. But unless we address some of the underlying barriers to build more housing in our housing ecosystem. We're not fully going to meet the moment. And what House Bill 4010 seeks to do is to create more pathways to do just that, to build more housing across the state in places where it makes sense, in places where Minnesotans are asking us to build it. I'll note a very broad coalition, a unique one, has formed to ask the legislature to take action here. It includes affordable housing providers and advocates, for-profit housing developers, realtors, climate and environmental justice advocates, our labor folks, our faith-based leaders. I really haven't seen a coalition like this that's coming together to say we need to do more, we need to be able to be creative and do things differently. So I just wanted to lay that base before discussing House Bill 4010 specifically. So House Bill 4010, what at its core, is a bill that will make it easier for multifamily housing to be built in already zoned commercial areas. This is something that is happening in many cases. It's a desire for communities across the state and for Minnesotans to live in walkable communities with access to neighborhoods and amenities. And the challenge is currently zoning and land use policies can make building that type of housing more expensive, challenging, and time consuming, leading to disparities and harms to our communities across the state. And so what this bill would do would be to reduce some of those barriers so that more housing can be built. It would also include some specific incentives to hopefully permit more affordable housing development in these areas, because what we've seen too often is affordable multifamily is not connected to walkable, areas of cities where they would like. And so that creates some disparities for our renters, especially if affordable housing can only be built in areas where they don't have access to those community amenities. And so this bill, it strives to seek that balance of making sure that we can build more housing in a streamlined fashion where it makes sense, while cities retain the ability to make sure that this housing is going where it makes sense. And I'll note that balance is, of course, an incredibly tricky one. It's one we've worked on all session long, and I think there's differences of opinions of where that balance is. I will say this bill that we're offering, we've really bent over backwards, I would say, to accommodate the concerns we've heard from cities. I've joked, I think I've spent more time with city lobbyists this session than my own family. But we've sought to make those changes in the interest of taking a positive step forward, and I believe that that's what this bill does.
Thank you. And with that, I think we'll just go ahead and get the bill in the order in which you would like it with the A3. But I believe you have an amendment. You would like an oral amendment to the A3. Is that correct?
That's right, Chair Cleavorn. I would just move an oral amendment to strike line 1.21 to line 2.2. This is a clause that we do not need. It's just one sentence.
Right. I would ask Mr. Gehring to talk to us about what, Ms. Griffin, if you would talk to us about what the amendment would do.
Sure. So, Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment would amend the amendment coded H4010A3. It would delete lines 1.21, so 1.22, and then on page 2, delete lines 1 and 2. It's removing paragraph E.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions about the oral amendment to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the amendment to the amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A3 is the A3 is amended with the oral amendment. Now to the A3 amendment itself.
Chair Cleavorn, the balance of this amendment is to remove some unnecessary language, and then also to further incorporate recommendations from the cities to create sort of flexibility or from their perspective on potential unintended consequences. Specifically, the previous bill had language around parking that said cities could not require more than one stall per unit for these types of housings. Now, with this amendment, it would say only within a quarter mile of transit could that restriction be put on place. The other piece we heard from cities is the desire to make sure that they can preserve the commercial that they already have. And so we have basically a no net loss provision here where cities would have the ability to say, we want to keep the level of commercial we have. So for example, you know, if a housing development proposal came in on a lot where there's already existing housing building, a city could say, we want to preserve what the commercial we have. So potentially maybe a mixed use housing could move forward in that instance. Those are the two big changes.
Thank you. Members, do you have any discussion to the A3 as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A3, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A3 as amended is adopted. Now, if you'd like, we can bring forward the testifiers for 4010 as amended.
Thank you.
Thank you. First, we have Paul Williams. You know, I just need to be really clear. We have a motion before us for House File 4010 as amended. The bill is on the table, and the motion is to re-refer the bill to the General Register. So just we're all clear about what we're doing. Mr. Williams, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Paul Williams. Good morning, Chair Cleverin and Vice Chair Hewitt. Members of the committee, appreciate your time today. Thank you, Representative Howard and Kozlowski for sponsoring this. My name is Paul Williams, and I'm the president and CEO of Project for Pride and Living. We're a nonprofit organization that builds affordable housing. Prior to coming to PPL, I served as the deputy mayor at the city of St. Paul for 3 years and have really spent the majority of my career in community development. I served on Governor Dayton's 2018 Housing Task Force and co-chaired Governor Walz's 2022 Housing Task Force on Economic acceleration. Both of those were really focused on, as Chair Howard spoke to, kind of the critical need for affordable housing and the intersections with a lot of different issues across our communities. PPL is a 52-year-old nonprofit affordable housing developer, property manager, service provider. We have 1,600 units of housing across the Twin Cities. About 3,500 folks live with us every night. Our housing spans Minneapolis, St. Paul, as well as several suburban areas. And much of our housing is located along commercial corridors and key transit routes. Land use and zoning barriers are significant impediments to the development of new housing in general and affordable housing in particular. Complicated processes with extensive timelines lead to long project delays and often include significant modifications that substantially reduce the number of housing units that can be developed on a given parcel while significantly driving up the cost of development. As an example, we are developing right now an affordable housing project in a western suburb that was originally designed for 100 units of workforce housing, two blocks from one of the new light rail stops on the Southwest Light Rail Line. After many rounds of public process, the building will include only 60 units. The project went from 100 to 80 to 60 when it opens later this year. The project will take almost six full years to get to completion, and the estimated cost increase due to project changes and delays is expected to total roughly $6 million. That's on a project that will total project cost of about $28 million. Ultimately, we end up having to come back to government and other sources to fill that gap. House File 4010 is designed to address these barriers, which will provide more opportunities to build more homes for more Minnesotans across the state, in the long run reducing the growth and the cost of housing, providing more housing that is in closer proximity to amenities and transportation options, and really strengthen our school districts. Importantly, locating more housing in and around commercial districts also helps to support the vital small businesses. So having more bodies and legs literally in the commercial district helps support those small businesses. That strengthens the tax base in those local communities. I also want to point out that there are elements that could make this bill go further in advancing the goal. We are particularly encouraging legislators to re-examine language and efforts around the conditional use permit process. That is a discretionary tool that historically has been used to deny or limit building housing, especially for our most vulnerable populations. In closing, we've been studying the housing crisis in Minnesota for over a decade, if not longer. The conclusions are clear that we desperately need more homes across the state to improve availability, affordability, and equity within our broader housing system. Governor Walz's Council on Economic Expansion clearly confirmed that in 2022. The 2018 Governor's Housing Study also made clear that reform of land use, to Representative Howard's point, the new funding is incredible and will help drive production. But if we don't reform the systems that control the land use or limit density, that drives costs up and will limit production in the long run. So we appreciate that this is continuing to move forward. We understand the complexities that the new development can create at the local level. Having been a deputy mayor myself, I very much understand that. But we ask that you continue to seek ways to limit barriers to housing development to ensure that all Minnesotans have a place to call home. Happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. And next we will have Daniel Lightfoot. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League represents the collective interests of 838 city governments across the state of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I certainly want to thank the author, Representative Kozlowski, and of course Chair Howard as well, for the numerous conversations that they have had with the League and a number of our member cities and city officials as well, and for the work that you, Madam Chair, Chair Howard, Representative Kraft, as well as Representative Kozlowski, have spent on this effort and on this bill and conversations with us. House File 4010, as amended by the A3, includes several changes that reflect those conversations, and we appreciate the work that has resulted in taking all of our suggestions to make the language more workable for cities. Those changes, as Chair Howard mentioned, include the ability for cities to establish official controls to require a continuation of commercial industrial property presence in an infill or new development for a multifamily residential development in commercial areas, the limitation on minimum parking requirements to just developments constructed under this section and within a quarter mile of a major transit stop, as well as the extension of the effective date to June 1 of 2025. These are important changes that will allow cities to ensure a balanced property tax base, prevent the underbuilding of parking resulting in overflow onto city streets that can't support dense parking, as well as allowing cities some time to prepare for this significant change in zoning and land use policy. While legislation that usurps local decision-making authority on zoning for residential development continues to be concerning and is not something the League can support, we do very much appreciate these changes to make the bill more workable and acknowledge that Representative Kozlowski and the others that I've mentioned have and will continue to work in good faith with the League and our member cities to find solutions to increase the availability of affordable multifamily housing. With that, just want to thank again to Chair Howard, to you, Madam Chair, and to the others that have worked on this bill for reflecting so many of our concerns in this language, in this iteration of language, and we certainly look forward to working with you and members as this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And next we have Anya McDonald for Metro Cities. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Chair Cleavorn and members, my name is Anya McDonald. I'm a government relations specialist with Metro Cities, and I want to first start thanking Representative Kozlowski and Chair Howard and other legislators to address a variety of concerns with provisions in the bill that have been raised by cities, similar to what Mr. Lightfoot just stated. We appreciate the language in the A3 amendment that allows for the preservation of commercial space. Many cities have identified that preserving and increasing commercial space is important for their local economy and to fulfill local needs. We appreciate that narrowing of the parking limitation to only new multifamily residential developments within one quarter mile of a major transit stop. We do continue to have concerns, however, with the bill, and as such continue to oppose the legislation. Metro City's policies oppose the preemption of local decision making over land uses and zoning. These are decisions best decided at the local level with local community input and with consideration over existing land uses and community circumstances. The bill ignores the role of local comprehensive plans, which all metropolitan cities have in effect, and that guide development and allow cities to plan for infrastructure over the long term. We would also just like to note that language on page 5, lines 5 through 8, is confusing as to what is considered contingent for approval of a project when going through an administrative review process. Finally, some provisions in the bill appear to be contradictory. For example, development needs to comply with existing infrastructure, but allows affordable housing developments to exceed maximum dimensional standards imposed by city official zoning controls. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate your being here. Next, we have Jason Waddell. Welcome, City Manager. If you would state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Cleavorn and members of the committee. My name is Jason Waddell, and I'm the Prior Lake City Manager. I'm also a licensed civil engineer and a former director of land development for a national home builder here in the Twin Cities. And today I'm testifying on behalf of our 19 member cities of the Municipal Legislative Commission. First, I do want to echo some of the previous comments and thank Chair Cleavorn and Representative Kozlowski for meeting with us over the last several weeks to discuss this bill. The current A3 amendment addresses many of the concerns we raised, and we are very appreciative of the work that has been done. One provision that we would suggest adding to this bill would be an exemption for cities that have greenfield areas available for multifamily housing. Amongst our 19 cities, we have 3,000 plus acres of land currently available for multifamily housing that would support upwards of 50,000 housing units. It is therefore unnecessary for our existing commercial areas to be subject to this bill. Rather, this bill should be applicable to those cities that are built out and don't have greenfield areas available. A couple other modifications we would like to suggest to this committee before advancing the bill. One would be the ability for affordable housing projects to exceed building height limits by 35 feet is concerning for us. For Prior Lake, that would allow an 80-foot tall apartment building to be located in our city. That's nearly double the size of our existing buildings, and we're just not set up to accommodate a building of that size. Our fire department isn't equipped to handle apartments of that size. So our thought is if development densities by right are desired to encourage affordable housing, then maybe addressing density through the floor area ratio standards, or maybe a slight height increase of 10% or something more reasonable, but an additional 35 feet is a little extreme in our opinion. And then lastly, the requirement that an administrative review process be created by cities to approve projects that fall within the provisions of this bill would remove public hearings and could put our cities at legal risk. For example, if city staff approve a project by right, and later are notified that there is a unique deficiency or an environmental condition of the site that was not considered, the city would solely bear the risk to a lawsuit. Hearings not only provide for community input, but they also reduce the risk or potential for downstream litigation as all are noticed and are granted an opportunity to point out deficiencies in a proposed project. So with that, I would just say, again, thank you so much, Chair Cleavorn and members of the committee, for the time. This bill has made a lot of progress, and we are very grateful for the modifications. And if you have any questions on any of the changes we are recommending, I would be happy to stand for questions.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank you for the time that you've spent with me as well. So thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't have you on the list. So please come forward. We do not want to leave you out.
There's one more. We have another testifier too.
Okay. Would that be you, Nancy Nordman? All right. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the testimony and begin your State your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, Chair and members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Wafel, and I am here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. Like others, I want to start by thanking Representative Kozlowski and others for their willingness to meet with us and learn about the concerns we have with this legislation. We've seen some really important changes, including limiting the restrictions on parking requirements, addressing concerns about the loss of commercial areas, and incorporating protections for general health and welfare. Our members continue to have concerns with this bill, however. Our overarching concern is that this bill does nothing to address the causes of the housing crisis we face in Greater Minnesota or address the barriers our communities face in trying to build more housing, but it does have the potential to create more challenges to our current efforts. Our member cities are very aware of the housing crisis, and they are doing everything they can to address it. They find it frustrating to sit through hearing after hearing where testifiers point at local government as the villain, especially when none of the evidence put forward this session supports the idea that zoning or the actions of local government leaders in Greater Minnesota are causing our housing crisis. The biggest problem with this bill is that it does not address the primary barrier to getting housing done in Greater Minnesota, which is cost. Virtually no project of any kind gets done in Greater Minnesota without the city providing financing assistance through grants, waiver of fees, tax increments financing, or tax abatement to close the financing gap that we have in our housing projects. Zoning is not the barrier to building housing in most of our communities. Rather, the barrier is the rapidly increasing cost of materials, infrastructure, financing, and labor. If a community can even find those to construct new housing. These are things that are holding back building housing in Greater Minnesota, not local zoning. With respect to the technical aspects of the bill, we are still concerned about problems that could hamper building affordable housing. When our cities are able to get affordable housing done, it is by working with developers, using CUPs, PUDs, and similar processes. We have concerns about the way this bill reworks processes, particularly around administrative review, that will make it harder, not easier, to build more housing, particularly the affordable and workforce housing we all want. In our already broken housing market, anything that puts more grits in the gears of progress only makes it harder for us to build. At the end of the day, we all share the goal of increasing housing for all Minnesotans, not just Greater Minnesota. But the challenge that we face is that this bill, as well as other major housing policy bills that were brought forward this session, were done without the involvement, insights, and advice of our local governments from Greater Minnesota. I've heard about this grand coalition, but we were never brought in. And while we appreciate the efforts of the author to incorporate our advice into 4010, had we been at the table months ago when they started crafting this bill, it would likely look much different and would work to help our rural communities build more housing. But we don't think that this bill meets the challenge that we are facing. If we want to create state policy to get more housing built, we believe the best course of action would be to step back and do a reset, to start a process where some of the most important stakeholders, cities from across the state, are built in at the beginning, brought in at the beginning of the process, not the end. We really do appreciate Representative Kozlowski's, Representative Howard's, Representative Cleveland's efforts to address our concerns, but by bringing us in at the end, not at the beginning, the result is a proposal that does not solve our housing problems. We hope to continue to work with Representative Kozlowski, Representative Howard, and others to ensure that we can get more housing done, especially affordable and workforce housing built in Greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, and I again will state that I appreciate the many conversations that you and I have had, and I look forward to our continued working together. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Nancy Nord-Bentz. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. I can't see who's coming forward. Thank you very much. Sometimes these tall chairs get in the way. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Cleveron, and members of the committee. My name is Nalima Sitatimunene. I'm the executive director of ACER. ACER is the African Career Education and Resources, Inc. I am here to testify on behalf of, in support of this bill, and I want to thank everybody, Chair Howard, for continuing to work on this bill. So ACER is the African Career Education and Resources, Inc. We're an issue-based organization, and our mission is to close the inequity gaps that exist within our communities. I'm also somebody who's worked in the community development field for a long time, and especially in housing. I had the pleasure to serve on the Metropolitan Council's Housing Policy Planning Work Group, where we came up with a housing plan for the region that hadn't been done in 25 years. Representative Howard and I are also both co-chairs of the 5th Congressional District's Housing Task Force, because we understand that housing, the housing crisis in Minnesota is a big crisis that we need to be addressing. So we testify in support of this bill because we realize that zoning reform is needed, especially to allow for more multifamily homes to be built in our state. And we know that state action is essential, because the state can no longer act with deference to practices that exclude people. In many places across our state, renters are majority in some cities, right? But as a community organization, we work with the community members who are impacted by these issues. And we know that many times, I've had a lot of cities and Coalition of Legal Cities testify, but as a community organization and the rest of the coalition members here who work in community organizations, we're the folks who are working with community members who a lot of times are not even being consulted by their cities and the decision makers in their cities, and also their decision makers. There's a huge disconnect between what people are actually experiencing in terms of their housing crisis and what community members actually need, and the decisions that are being made within their local government. And it is important for all those voices to be heard, because they are the ones experiencing these challenges. The experiences of renters in our community is almost like that of second-class citizens. In our communities, multifamily is sparsely zoned, and it's often on the periphery of a community. And zoning has been used to create and perpetuate segregation. So trusting cities to use tools with a proven discriminatory outcome to miraculously achieve different outcomes today is wishful thinking. Because as community organizations, as community members, we have tried and tried, and that is why we have this bill before us today. Now, our experiences with cities, especially when it comes to adapting long-term plans, and especially like comp plans have been talked about a lot, we have realized, and I have lived across some of the cities, they're using cookie-cutter comp plans. And there's most of the time, there's no engagement, again, with the community members who are in need of this housing. And a lot of times these plans don't zone to make it any easier to build multifamily housing, especially affordable housing. Maintaining the status quo, discretionary reviews empowers some and disempowers most. As somebody who works in community engagement, I'm a huge advocate and proponent of community engagement, engaging community. But I also know that public input is, although it's a powerful resource, when public input results in a disparate impact and harms efforts to further fair housing, then the state has an obligation to intervene. I know that market rate projects on one, I've seen market rate projects on one side of a street that get a green light, while affordable housing projects right on the other side of the street face insurmountable objection. And what I will say is, affordable housing is some of the housing that undergoes so much scrutiny that market rate housing does not undergo at all.
I'm going to ask you to wrap your
time. Sure, I'm wrapping up. Just because the city says that they're going to do the right things and has good intention means the outcomes back the claims. Minnesota needs more than 100,000 units for households with the lowest incomes. Homelessness is an epidemic in our state, and fighting bureaucracy and home owner opposition adds time and cost. It can even kill projects. And we're here because we're saying we cannot afford for projects to be derailed and killed if we do not invest in enough resources. Every penny should go to building homes, and we should not be adding costs for the sake of local control.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your voice being at the table, and thank you for being with us this morning. And members, as you know, Lead Nash and I had an agreement at the beginning of this, of our work together as state and local government, that we would always allow community voice first. So it's going to tighten the time that we have for member conversation. So I'm going to ask for your questions to be very concise. And then we still have one more bill after this. So we are moving on to member questions now. Representative Joy, you have the first question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And mine's not a question. It's just a, you know, it's interesting when I look at this bill. I don't think this bill's ready for game time. I think this bill needs a lot of work. I have a city next to me that's a population of 1,345 people, and I just got a letter of support from them yesterday asking them to support a 47-unit apartment building. This is the city doing their work as local officials. This is a, and they're saying the problem they're having is the gap, so they are applying for a workforce housing grant to close this gap because of what the construction is. It's nothing to do with zoning, but 80% of the teachers in that town have to travel because we don't have housing. So I think the zoning thing has nothing to do with it. These guys are moving forward, if they can get this grant, on local officials. I think it's important that we continue to allow public input, allow the local people to have this, and not put these zoning regulations in place. What works today for these cities in my area to continue is what they're doing. I have another city that's looking at an 80 unit. And they're doing that on their own. They don't need the legislator to come down and tell them how we should do zoning. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howard, you and I have had some great discussions on this. As you know, my three cities are totally opposed to this bill. In fact, they did a resolution for something. But I also, as a realtor, know the importance of this. And I know that last night my team wrote a 21st offer for a first-time home buyer that offered well over $25,000, and I'm sure we'll be turned down for that one too. My concerns with this bill are that most my three cities are in major development right now with a lot of their commercial property. And a lot of the areas you did address, utilities, big one, transportation, another one where these industrial areas or commercial areas don't have that that spot where they could have a bus or we don't have rail out there, so it doesn't matter. The last one I'm really concerned about because many of my areas, as well known, Rosemount has a, what we'd consider a heavy industrial I-1 area. And it looks like you, and I just want to correct it if I'm wrong, you addressed this in the bill that this would not be, I'm worried that that's for some of our most affordable land and commercial, that a lot of these affordable housing units would be pushed out there. And is that, it looks like you kind of exempted it from the bill, but if you could address my issues, then I'll shut up.
Chair Howard.
Chair Cleveland, Representative Hewitt, please don't ever shut up. I really enjoy our conversations. The bill says that housing can be in areas where commercial is already allowed. But, you know, it's permissive. And to your point, that's partly the reason for the bill, to make it available not just in areas that aren't desirable, so to speak, but available to be in commercial zones. So our hope what this would do is create a diversity of and more options for housing to be in commercial areas where it makes sense with cities' ability to be part of that process.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Hewitt, did you have any further?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howard, just a couple things, and you know my district has a lot of it's fairly old development, not a lot of new opportunity, more redevelopment, and just how would this affect that? I mean, we've got old commercial sites that are no longer in use. If you could just elaborate a little bit on that,
Chair Howard,
Chair Cleveland, Representative Hansen, and I think this is a lot of cities want to see redevelopment in these areas. My city is in a similar place, and so. This would allow for a lot of what already is allowed, I would guess, in cities. So let's say a specific example, there's an area where there's an existing kind of dilapidated building. A housing developer could come and say, we want to do some multifamily housing here. And a city could decide, yes, and with this bill, there's a system that could be potentially streamlined so that that process could work better for the city and for the developer to move forward with housing. Now, let's say that your city wants to preserve the commercial that's there. They could tell the housing developer, yes, you can come here, but this needs to be mixed use. We want to preserve the commercial we have. And so could work with the developer to make sure that what's coming forward is a mixed use. And so that creates win-wins, you know, that, in my opinion, this bill is going to allow for more of that collaboration between housing developers and cities to create more of that redevelopment opportunity, grow tax base, and create outcomes that I think cities, communities, people all want.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howard, I think it's important to just note that the introduction of the bill is the beginning of a process. We had testimony earlier today about beginnings and endings. And, you know, as legislators, we represent people. And you've been modifying this bill based on the input of people. I know some have the view of that stakeholders should get together, work it out, and present it to us, and it'll be perfect, and that we should just adopt it. I think our role, and I think what you've been doing, is a different approach, which is the public approach, which is the proper approach. Is you can take the input, you can develop a bill, but when you introduce the bill, when others introduce the bill, that you're doing on behalf of your constituents, and all of us have to represent our constituents, not the stakeholders. They can continue to provide input, and they can provide testimony, but the power of people is here that we're supposed to represent. And evolution, adaption, changing, which I understand is what's continuing to happen here, makes a stronger bill than the approach of working it out with the stakeholders, bringing it to us, and having us adopt it.
Lead Kosnick.
Thank you. A couple questions. You know, we hear the 100 units are needed. How do we
100,000
or 100,000? Thank you. 100,000 units. How do we derive, or how do we know that, or where's that cited from?
Chair Howard.
Chair Clevo and Representative Kosnick, I believe Minnesota Housing Partnership puts together really complex data and analysis, and to really simplify, it's just a math equation of folks at certain income levels and their ability to find homes that they can actually afford. And that's how far we're short in terms of the basic supply and demand. There's a much more complex answer to that, but at its core, it's basic arithmetic.
Madam Chair and Representative Howard, if you could forward us that study or something, that, you know, I think that would be helpful, because I know that there's a little bit ambiguity in that, some people want to better understand how we get to that than having a. I've got some ideas, you know, from a former real estate license holder. What was my other?
We're going to move quickly, so please.
Nope. Does your bill does it identify affordable housing and multifamily housing projects that are currently in progress that cities are already undertaking?
Chair Howard.
Chair Cleveland, Representative Kosnick, if I understand your question, would this bill implicate developments that are underway? And I would say the answer is no. We have an effective date that it's forward-looking. So things in this bill wouldn't be sort of retroactive, if that's answering your question.
Madam Chair, Chair Howard, so projects that are currently undertaken. I know there's a lot in the South Metro, so those wouldn't count in that, is what I hear you saying. And then finally, how does this bill interact with requirements from the Metropolitan Council, comprehensive planning documents and requirements? How do they work together?
Chair Howard.
Chair Clevone, Representative Kosnick. Essentially what this bill would do would create some conditions to allow cities to update their own plans based on what the legislature is providing. So it doesn't have a direct involvement. The Met Council activities, I would say, could interact, because I think if adopted, cities would be able to hopefully be building more housing, meeting more goals, all of those kinds of things. But there isn't sort of, the Met Council doesn't have a prescribed role in this bill.
Final question.
I think I heard that. I guess the final question would be then, you know, we did, under your leadership last year, quite a bit allocation of dollars, like $1 billion towards housing and affordable housing. How much of that, those funds, how much of that has been used and utilized towards affordable housing?
Chair Howard.
Chair Cleveland, Representative Kosnick, great question. Of that billion plus, roughly about 40% of it has been allocated. And I know we're short on time, but this is partly in response to Representative Joy's conversation and some of the testimony. We agree. We need, and we agree that in Greater Minnesota, I think the it's a little bit different scenario, and the economics are particularly busted to build housing in Greater Minnesota. That's why the legislature passed historic money directly for Greater Minnesota last year in our bill. It's why we passed new revenues that flow directly to counties and cities for the first time ever. But we shouldn't set up this sort of false choice either or. We need more public investment. We also need to reduce some of the barriers. But so a significant amount has been deployed. A lot of that will go towards building affordable housing units. But we can't maximize those dollars if underlying it we have rules that sort of prevent those projects and those dollars to be maximized.
Thank you, Chair Howard.
And then, Madam Chair, if I could request a roll call, you know, kind of looking at some of the numbers, especially in the metro area, you know, a significant amount of the new housing is multifamily units in that. I think the bill sometimes misses the mark of actually doing affordable housing versus multifamily and creating density. And so we would request a roll call, please.
Thank you very much. A roll call has been requested. I will renew my motion to re-refer House File 4010 as amended to the General Register. Please take the roll.
Chair Cleavorn?
Aye.
Chair Cleavorn? Aye. Vice Chair Hewitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hewitt? Aye. Representative Nash? Excused. Representative Bonner? Excused. Representative Berg?
Aye.
Representative Berg? Aye. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg? Aye. Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Hansen? Aye. Representative Harder? Representative Harder, no. Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Herr, aye. Representative Joy?
No.
Representative Joy, no. Representative Kosnick?
No.
Representative Kosnick, no. Representative Nadeau, excused. Representative Newton, excused. The ayes are 6, nays are 3, with 4 excused.
4 excused? Yep. With 6 ayes, 3 nays, 4 excused, the motion prevails, and House File 4010, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you very much, Chair Howard.
Thank you, Chair Cleaver, and thank you, members.
All right, next we'll have up House File 5328, and Vice Chair Hewitt, if you'll take the gavel, please.
Chair Cleavorn, you have a bill before us.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I would like House File 5328 to be laid over for possible inclusion in our policy, in our bill. Thank you.
To your bill.
Thank you. House File 5328 is grants clarification, and it establishes a state building renewable energy storage and electrical vehicle account. The pieces that I'll be discussing in this committee really have to do with the grants clarification, and they correct an appropriation to the Enterprise Grants Management System feasibility study, and they clarify capital cash grants process. And with that, I have Commissioner Tamar Grunville with me, who can speak more to the bill.
And Commissioner, if you could state your name, title, and continue with your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Tamar Grunville. I'm the chair of, I'm the commissioner of the Department of Administration. It's good to be with all of you this morning. The governor's recommendation contained in House File 5328 reflects admin's efforts to clarify ambiguities and help our partners take advantage of federal funding opportunities. Admin's requests are budget-neutral policy changes and technical clarifications. First, the governor recommends establishing the state building renewable energy storage and electric vehicle account. This will enable admin to leverage federal funds and improve the resilience of agency operations. Admin's Office of Enterprise Sustainability works with agencies to help them improve the energy efficiency of their operations and avoid facility energy costs. In this work, agencies have told us they need resources to make renewable energy and storage improvements. The Federal Inflation Reduction Act created a program for non-taxed entities called direct pay in lieu of tax credits to non-taxed entities. This program provides cash rebates for eligible renewable energy investments and electric vehicle purchases. The private sector has had access to these tax credits for many years. Legislation is needed to clarify where direct pay credits will go. This proposal would create an account to receive the federal direct pay cash rebates and return them to the relevant agency or be used to fund future renewable energy and storage projects. This proposal is only for the policy language to establish the fund in the statute. The governor has also recommended a general fund appropriation to seed this account in the capital budget. This proposal, combined with the capital budget request, will make a real impact, especially for agencies with 24/7 operations, resident operations in particular, like DHS, corrections, and the vets homes. Potential renewable energy production and energy storage systems include solar arrays and ground source heat pumps, among others. Eligible projects at state facilities can qualify for a cash rebate from the federal government of 6% to 50% of the cost to install these systems. Admin will work with agencies to identify eligible projects and administer the logistics to receive the federal funds.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Chair Cleburne, it looks like you have one more testifier, or?
We do. Jen Hassimer from the Assistant Commissioner of Debt Management from MMB.
Assistant Commissioner, if you can come to the mic. Ms. Hassimer? Hassimer, if you could state your name, title, and continue with the testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jennifer Hassimer, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. I believe Commissioner Granvall was going to make an initial statement, and then I'll follow up with a couple additional remarks.
Commissioner?
Vice Chair, I wanted to preview very briefly the next piece of this. The governor recommends a budget-neutral technical clarification to the Office of Grants Management's appropriation to conform the session law with the spreadsheet that the conference committee adopted. Finally, the governor recommends clarifying the process for organizations to follow who were appropriated cash capital grants, and my colleague here will testify about the specifics on that.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Assistant Commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Vice Chair and members of the committee, thank you again. I was happy to take any questions on the proposed statutory amendment to make some modifications to the grants management statutes in Chapter 16B, and also wanted to provide a brief remark about the provision in Article 2 of House File 5328 as well, which is just a technical fiscal housekeeping proposal, which would change where a portion of the motor vehicle lease sales tax revenue is deposited from the State Transportation Fund, which is a fund for bond proceeds issued by the state, to the Special Revenue Fund instead. This would simply correct the current situation where state bond proceeds are being commingled with sales tax revenue and would reflect good fiscal management practices. And that proposal was developed in consultation with MnDOT and would not represent a change in the amount of revenues raised or the uses of the revenues as well. And I'm happy to take questions on either of those proposals.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. And this is a public hearing. Is there anyone else in the House wishing to testify on 5328? Seeing none, rushing to the stand. Chair Cleburne, if you want, I can open it for member discussion.
Please, if you would.
Members of discussion. I get to call you lead today, I guess. Lead Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that last point, could you just clarify? I get a little bit nervous having spent 8 years on the Transportation Committee and probably looking to go back there. The use of transportation dollars, and just clarify, I want to make sure that transportation dollars remain for the roads, bridges, and intended purpose. But
and Lee Kosnick, that was to Assistant Commissioner?
Yes, please.
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Vice Chair and Representative. That is correct. The use of the funds will stay for the designated transportation purposes already outlined in statute. This would merely change where the funds are deposited.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank
you. Is there a follow-up there? No more discussion?
My other members may have questions.
I don't see them on the list right now.
No, I appreciate the clarification.
Thank you. Seeing no other discussion, Chair Cleburne, would you like to close your bill?
Thank you very much. And just for the members' knowledge, there's also, for the motor vehicle sales tax piece, there is another bill, a clone of this language that is moving separately, and that would be heard in transportation and taxes. So I just want to make that clarification. Again, we're laying this over for possible inclusion, so I'm always welcoming your questions and concerns at that time. Thank you.
At this point, Chair Cleburne lays the bill over for possible inclusion. 5328 will be laid over in our committee. This is our business for today. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, April 16th, 2024 at our normal time. We stand adjourned.